Say hi to everyone. Glad you're here. And especially welcome to Nancy Baim. We're very happy that you take your time to visit us here at the Oslo Met during your European talk series, going from London to Oslo to Copenhagen and Amsterdam and back to Microsoft Research Center in Boston. And we're pleased to hear about Nancy's new book. Unfortunately, we don't have a display copy here today, but you will introduce it, building on her well-reputed ways of doing interviews and field work with musicians and letting us understand the more personal and intimate relationships that musicians can have with their audiences in different ways. And Nancy will also talk to us briefly about how it is to be a researcher at Microsoft Research Center. I deliberately asked Nancy to say a few words about this because it's a very special situation. Nancy was a very known professor and one of the, I'd say, key scholars within the Association of Internet Researchers, where she's been a keynote and had a leading function for many years, and was headhunted to Boston to work at the Social Media Collective and so forth. And it's a very specific type of situation, I think, and how you work with the MIT and so forth. So we'll be happy to hear a little bit about that too. Anyhow, I'll let you have the scene. Thank you.
I tend to talk fast, so if I'm too fast, just tell me to slow down. And if you have questions, just let me know. I don't mind stopping to answer questions. So I hate having things in front of me when I'm talking, but I'll cope. I wasn't really prepared to talk about working at Microsoft, but I'll tell you some things about it. So as Oscar said, I was a university professor for 18 years before I went to Microsoft in a communication program doing sort of media studies and interpersonal communication. Microsoft is an unusual company in that it still has a unit that's devoted to basic research, meaning that our job is not to work on products. There are a lot of PhDs with a lot of research expertise within the company who do work on products, but they're within product groups. So, for example, there's a guy who works in Xbox managing the Halo online fan community, and he's got a PhD in neuropsychology, and he knows how to evaluate all kinds of things. He's an incredibly sophisticated methodologist, but he works specifically on Xbox and on Halo. In research, on the other hand, our job is the same as professors' jobs, which is to advance the state of knowledge in our field. So it's a very unusual situation where we're free to design our own research projects. People don't tell us what to do. People don't expect it to be easily transferred into Microsoft products. So like when I left the university and went to work there, people sort of said, oh, are you going to work on Microsoft Word? No. That is not what I do work on Microsoft Word. That's how I write my books, but that's about it. And I have all the same complaints about it that anybody else does. So Microsoft Research has got several labs. We have one in Cambridge, UK, which is quite large. We have a huge one in Redmond, Washington, where Microsoft is headquartered. That one's got almost 500 people working there, all PhDs. My lab is a small one. We are about 20 permanent researchers there, and we're very interdisciplinary. So my group, which we call the Social Media Collective, has three main people, me, Mary Gray, and Tarleton Gillespie. And we all do research about communication technologies and their roles in society and how they impact society and how society impacts them. But we also have people who do machine learning. We have people who do economics. We have people who do cryptography, theoretical math. One of my closest colleagues for the last, well, actually they solved the problem last year, but he spent 20 years working on the problem of how do you most efficiently pack spheres in 24-dimensional space. And if you can't understand that, it's not because of English skills. It's because it's completely esoteric and confusing. And we have people doing bioinformatics. So it's a very, very eclectic group of people with a lot of different interests. And we all try to learn about each other's fields and be stimulated by them and engaged with each other. So that's what I do. I show up there and I just do my work. And it's a really delightful, delightful place to be. I had never thought I would work in industry. I thought I'd be a university professor forever. I do have an affiliation at MIT where I do continue to work with students, and every once in a while I teach. But for the most part, I just do my scholarship. So people sometimes will say, oh, you're interviewing musicians and writing about musicians. How does Microsoft feel about that? And the answer is, that's what they pay me for. That's my job. It's a great job. So what I want to do today is to just give you a bit of a sneak peek at the book that I've got that came out last summer called Playing to the Crowd, about musicians and their relationships with audiences. So I think I will just plunge on in. And like I said, if you have questions or examples or anything at any point, please don't be shy about asking. Since I work with economists, I'm very used to being interrupted. So this is one of the artists I spoke with, Mark Kelly, from a British band called Marillion, who've been around quite a long time. And this quote I like to use, I open the book with this quote because it really boils down into a nutshell so much of the problem that interests me, which is this idea that in the past, musicians, rock stars, were almost like gods, right? They were up in the sky, and there was no way you would ever know them. You would never be tweeting with them. You'd never be interacting with them in comments on their Facebook page. Maybe you'd write a fan letter, and maybe somebody from their management office would send you back an autographed picture if you were very lucky. But you would never expect to be able to interact directly with them. And then after MySpace, this really changes. And what happens is that, as he says, people are tweeting about what they had for breakfast or whatever. And as a result of this, it's very hard to know what the boundaries are and where to draw them. So it's this problem of blurry boundaries and what happens when people who used to be very separate suddenly are expected to be in direct interaction. So that's kind of my core problem that I'm looking at. Let me give you a couple of examples of the kinds of interactions that are expected. These are obviously not from social media. This is real life. But it happens offline as well as online. So this is Rihanna, whom you may recognize. She is known for having fantastic meet and greets. Okay, so you pay some extra money, you get to meet Rihanna, and as you can see, if you're lucky enough to have the opportunity to do this, you might get to have some pretty intimate interactions with her, right? You might get to squeeze her bottom. She might squeeze your breasts. Maybe if you're lucky, she'll ride on top of you or kiss you. These are very, very close interactions, right? If you are like me, the thought of doing these things with strangers is kind of scary, right? It doesn't really sound fun. But she's widely regarded as being incredibly good at this. And BuzzFeed a few years ago wrote a pretty wonderful piece where they compared her and how she is at meet and greets and how good she is at it to Avril Lavigne. And how bad she is at it, right? So everybody made fun of her and we all laugh and it is funny. One of the things that to me is striking about this is that, you know, I'm sure you hear this rhetoric all the time. Everybody wants everybody to be authentic, right? People want their celebrities to be authentic. Well, she's being very authentic. She really doesn't like to be touched. This is the real her, not wanting to be touched, and people don't like it, right? So when people say be authentic, what they often mean is be intimate, be close. Come on in. Oh, too bad. Too late.
I'm so sorry.
That's all right. No worries. We're just getting started. So I started blogging about music fans, oh gosh, about 12 years ago now probably. And, 13, it's 2019. So a million years ago I started blogging about music fans. And one thing that happened to that was I started getting invited to come to music industry events to tell people how to connect with their audiences. One of my favorites is BLARM, which I've been able to speak at 4 times. My favorite. And I'd be at these events, and I would hear people telling artists that they needed to connect with their audiences. If they wanted to be able to have a sustainable career, they needed to engage their audiences, they needed to connect. And then I would hear musicians saying things like, what am I supposed to post? Do I need to use Flickr? Is Flickr important? And I realized that they were being told to do something that they really had no idea how to do. They were very confused about it. They might be great on stage, they might be great musicians, but the idea that they were supposed to connect was very confusing. And I always say it's sort of like if you move to a new town and you say, I don't know anybody, I'm very lonely, and somebody gives you the advice, oh, well, connect. Right? And you still don't know anybody, and you're still alone, and you still don't know what to do. You just have a buzzword now for what you don't know how to do. So I started thinking somebody needs to study this, and I not long after realized that I was the only person in the room who was a researcher, and perhaps that was going to be my job. So what I did was to interview about 40 artists, a few managers as well, spent a lot of time online following musicians and their fans, paid a lot of attention to what was happening at concerts in terms of connection, went to, like I said, to BLARM, to Midem, to other music industry events. I'm not going to talk about it now, but there is a section in the book where I use my own long history as a music fan to talk about what it was like to be a fan before the internet and after the internet and how that's changed those dynamics. And then I did a lot of iterative close analysis where I just go through the, like I had 800 pages of interview transcripts, and I would go through and I would say, what point is he making here? What point is she making there? What point is he making there? What point is she making? And I would have pages and pages and pages of points these people were making. And then I would sort of try to collapse them and go back through and just over and over and over again until I really, it took years to get a really clear sense of what does this boil down to? What's kind of a core way to explain this really complicated phenomenon? And that's what I'll share with you today. These are some of the artists I spoke with. You can see I got a few Norwegians in there, as well as people from the United States, Canada, England, Sweden, Australia, even got a Spaniard in there for Raul. Most of these artists, everybody who is in white, they had had audiences before MySpace, before the internet happened. So they had really built their careers in a time when there was no expectation of direct engagement with audience members. Maybe you would have an autograph signing at a record store or something like that, but there was no expectation that you were going to be in continuous contact. The people who are in blue were right at that edge. So like Sivert Høyem described himself as the last of the analog musicians because Industrial Silence came out 3 years before MySpace. So they got to be big rock stars, but then by the time they did their second album, suddenly there was this real shift and they were expected to be in ongoing interaction with their audiences. So, and then the people in blue, in the light blue, they are people who established their careers, or the gray, sorry, people in the gray, they established their careers after MySpace had already happened and didn't really know a music world where they didn't have to be in contact. So the reason I did that, I did this way is that there's a real tendency when you're looking at new media and the internet to think that whatever you're looking at here has never ever happened before. This is a brand new thing and it's all because of whatever platform you're looking at. And if there's one thing that we know from years of social research, it's that most things actually do have historical precedents. And if you want to understand what's new, you really have to understand what's old, because otherwise you mistake things that are old for things that are new. So this is a way to speak with people who could say, oh, well, it used to be like this, but now it's like this. But who could also say, well, this is still happening. This used to happen before, and it still happens now. All right. So I want to, this is an outline of what I want to talk to you about. I know that you guys are not music students, so I want to talk a bit about, I imagine some of you are music fans. So I want to talk a bit about why study music if you're not interested in music. Why, for example, is it relevant for journalism to think about music, or for politics to think about music? I want to contrast music as a form of communication, which it is and has always been, with music as a business, which historically speaking is a fairly modern invention. I'll talk about how social media platforms push us toward particular kinds of relationships and ways of interacting, and the tensions that get raised by those pushes. And then I'll close up by thinking about how benefits get distributed in this new system. So music is prediction. The French polymath Jacques Attali gave a talk at Harvard some years ago that he called music as a predictive social science. And I like this phrase very much because it speaks to the idea that, as he argues, oftentimes cultural trends happen in music first. And this has been true for about all of recorded history. Music has always been a few steps ahead of the curve. So, for example, does anybody recognize what this object is? I always like to ask. This is a bone flute. It's from about 40,000 years before Christ. It's a very sophisticated piece of technology. It's carved from bird bones, from the ribs of large birds. It's got beveled holes to fit fingers. It has fixed pitch. It had an adhesive mouthpiece that was glued on. And there are quite a few of these. This is not the only one that's ever been found. 40,000 years, this is the same age as the cave paintings in Lascaux, which are très famous. For some reason, the bone flute is not famous, and I don't really understand why, because it's one of the first pieces of technology that we have after arrowheads, right? It's one of the earliest forms of human technology. So basically, as soon as humans got past creating hunting tools, we started making music-making tools. That's how core music is to our being. So music predicts technology in that regard. Music has also been viewed as having been ahead of the curve on individualism, this move from everybody should just be part of the community to be yourself, stand out. And sometimes this gets located in the invention of print, of written notation. Notation has the interesting quality that for the first time music becomes an object rather than a behavior or a practice. It's a thing now. There's a thing that you can take and say, here, have a song, and hand somebody a song without making music. But it also has the quality that you could write your name on it. This is a Bach piece, and this is his signature up here. So what happens when Johann Sebastian Bach can write his name on it? This was obviously not 1200 AD. He was a little bit later than that, but it's the best old one I could find. What happens is that it becomes possible for the first time to think of something like music as something that an individual made, that is located in the mind of a genius, right? Instead of, as it would always have been, a gift from the gods that just comes through people, right? So over time, you get this idea that art comes from individuals, but this idea that an individual created it rather than it's a communal thing that we all have access to, you see very early in music. You also see it in soloists stepping out of the chant. So to up till around 1200, music in the West would be performed usually in a group chant where everybody would sing together. And around 1200, you start having soloists who step out and perform. Music is also way ahead of the curve on the fear that automation and robots will steal our jobs, which is very popular right now. This is about 100 years old, this image. And what it's referencing is that for all everybody's talk about the music industry being harmed by downloading and piracy and all of that, the invention of recording actually decimated professional musicians. Before recorded sound, every theater in the United States anyway, and many other parts of the world, employed an in-house orchestra, because if you're going to show a movie, you had to have somebody making the sound, right? So there was an in-house orchestra, and as soon as film got sound, half of those people lost their jobs immediately, because you had not a robot playing the harp of money, but you had recorded music replacing live musicians. So this fear of technology is going to replace our jobs, you see very early in music also. You hear a lot of talk now about the gig economy also, which musicians, not only were they ahead of the curve on the gig economy, they named it, right? Where does the word gig come from? It's a, I got a gig tonight, I'm going to go play my instrument in front of a crowd, right? This is from the Bureau of Labor Statistics in the United States, describing what the gig economy is, and interestingly, they start by focusing on a musician. So they say he works wherever, whenever. He's a songwriter who sells customized jingles and videos. And they quote him as saying, "It's really a dream come true. It gives me the freedom to set my own hours, and I can do what I do anywhere there's an internet connection." And indeed, this idea that the gig economy is about freedom and movement, and you can do what you want, wherever you want to do it, whenever you want to do it. These are the ideals of the gig economy, and they are something that musicians have been doing for quite a long time. So musicians do exemplify the qualities that are prized in the gig economy. They're flexible, they work in teams, they're entrepreneurial, their work is project-based, they're mobile, all of these qualities. But they also exemplify what's really scary about the gig economy. There's no promise of a next job. There's no social safety net to catch you if you don't get that next job. There's no support to help you. It's very precarious, and you're quite vulnerable. So both in positive ways and negative ways, musicians were ahead on the gig economy. Musicians were also, well, not necessarily musicians, but music fans were very ahead of the curve on the internet. So, as you may or may not know, the internet, as we know it now, is often credited as having begun in 1969, when the first two nodes of the internet connected, one of which was in Southern California, and one of which was in the Bay Area in Northern California. And in particular, Stanford University in Palo Alto, California, which is right by San Francisco. So this is 1969, 1970, 1971, and this is a time in San Francisco in particular where the Grateful Dead are the most important things in the history of the universe. Right, Deadheads are a huge phenomenon at this time. And I don't know how much you know about Grateful Dead fandom, but it's kind of the original fandom, right? The Deadheads kind of invented the whole following the band on tour all over the place and making friends with other people who went along with you and all of that. So many of these people who were computer scientists inventing the internet were big Grateful Dead fans. They were also science fiction fans. So it's not unique to music. One of the first things that happened in, this is what computers looked like then. This would just be the dummy terminal that you were using, but this is what was actually doing all the computation. One of the first things that they did was to type up all the Grateful Dead lyrics, to digitize all the lyrics, and they printed them all out, and one of them gave them to this fellow, John Perry Barlow, who was lyricist for the Grateful Dead. Barlow was really, really impressed. The Grateful Dead got very interested in technology. And then he went on to co-found the Electronic Frontier Foundation and to be a very important figure in shaping the internet for years afterwards. Another example of music being foundational to the formation of computer-mediated communication is community memory, which was the first community computer network that was ever created. And the idea here was that just as you would, you know, when you go into a coffee house or something like that and there's a bunch of things pinned up on the bulletin board, like I'll walk your dog for you, or I'll babysit, or I lost my cat, or guitar lessons or whatnot, you would do this on this. You do it, so you would go to the place where this was, and you would be able to read what everybody said for free, and if you wanted to write, you could put in 25 cents, and you could leave a message of your own. Where did they put this very first thing? They put it in a record store in Berkeley. So again, you have music fans at the center of early computing. And of course, music led the curve on having your business model destroyed by the internet, much as journalism is now experiencing or has been experiencing for the last few years. This is what happened between the year 2000 and 2014 to album sales. Quite a drop, right? And you can see that single sales have gone up a little bit. We're now starting to see streaming revenues going up. So the curves are going up a little bit, but the whole model of sell albums is just dead. You know, if you're lucky, you can sell an album, but for the most part, people are buying singles or more likely streaming at this point, and not paying for a streaming subscription, but not paying for individual pieces of music. And then music in many ways led the curve on social media. So it's kind of laughed at now, but MySpace, which was not the first social network site, there were other social networking sites before MySpace, Black Planet being a really common, popular one. But MySpace was the first one that kind of everybody heard of, right? It stopped being this niche thing and became something where your next door neighbor might have a MySpace account and ask you why you don't, right? What do you mean you're not on MySpace? Everybody's on MySpace. MySpace was created in Los Angeles, and the people who developed MySpace very intentionally used music in order to make it popular. And they did this by building music into it, so that this is what the front page of it looked like, and there was a section, MySpace Music. And did any of you ever have MySpace profiles? Kind of, yeah, right? So if you vaguely remember, you could choose songs to put on your profile, right? It was just part of your... If you went to Nancy Baim's profile on MySpace, you could listen to what the songs I had put there. So they really put music in the middle of it, and they got the musicians in Los Angeles to use it. That was what they seeded it with. So in a way, the whole explosion of social networking sites that we take for granted owes a lot to that early seeding of music and their audiences and trying to get musicians and audiences to use these platforms together. So my argument in the book is that what music is predicting now, if it's predicted all these things over history, you can look at this moment and say, what does it predict now? What does it tell us about the future? And my argument is that it predicts a future where if you want to be marketable, if you hope to be employed, there's an expectation in more and more fields that you're going to form relationships with audiences or potential customers or clients or parishioners or constituents or voters, whatever kinds of people you want to reach, that look sort of semi-intimate, right? It might not be Rihanna grabbing your butt, but it's going to look a little more like friendship than like that distant, aloof relationship from the past. And this is going to happen through multiple modes of connection. And it's not just one-on-one, it's you talking to crowds of people, Twitter followers, Facebook fans. I I call this work of doing this relational labor. There are a lot of different kinds of labor that get talked about these days, and in using the term relational labor, what I want to emphasize is this ongoing work of building connection, right? When I say being told to connect as a way of making friends is absurd on its face, what I'm saying is it's work. These are processes. These are things that you have to do day in and day out. You know, it's not like you get a relationship and congratulations, you made a relationship, you're done, you can stop now. You have to keep doing it. You have to keep working at it. So this process of building relationships and maintaining them, it's ongoing. It never really ends. It's interactive. It's not something you can just do and sit back and watch it happen. You have to keep doing it with other people. It's emotional. It involves feeling. It's material. You need to have the devices. You know, it requires actual things. And it's mental. It's a lot of mental effort to make sense of all of this. And it has to happen over time. And you're doing it, at least in part, to create the structures that will keep you marketable. And that doesn't mean that it always feels like work. And it doesn't mean that it isn't pleasurable. Often the people I spoke with took a lot of pleasure in it and had very meaningful moments that happened through it. But it's nonetheless essential for work. And it often is not fun. Right? There's parts of it that are wonderful, and there's parts of it that are not wonderful. So there's this expectation that there's going to be relational labor. Part of the call for this can be traced to some of the ways that intimacy has changed over time historically. It used to be that intimacy was sort of something that you got to do in private with your family when you got home. You could get away from public life and you could go home and close the doors and have your intimate relations. It was your refuge away from public life. But starting around the 1940s and then really coming into its own in the 1970s, the expectation sort of started shifting to where intimacy becomes something that you do in public as part of your work. And so Arlie Hochschild, in this book, The Managed Heart, wrote about the commercialization of human feeling, and this is the book in which she came up with the term emotional labor, which you may have heard. And she talks about flight attendants whose job is partly to keep that pleasant smile on your face, to look pretty so that people like the way you look until not all that long ago, flight attendants had to be skinny and young and beautiful. If you were a fat person, you couldn't possibly be a flight attendant. There was a real standard of beauty that was expected because you had to make people feel good, and heaven forbid somebody who wasn't gorgeous could do that. And they're supposed to be making people happy, right? That's sure, their job is to save your life in case of an emergency, but on a day-in, day-out basis, their job is to make the men and women on board feel calm and happy. She also wrote about the guys who come repossess your car when you fall behind on your payments and how their job was to create the emotion of fear and intimidation in the people they were interacting with. So you have these kinds of precedents. There are some other ways of thinking about these sorts of labor that show up. So this is just a sampling of books about relatively recent books thinking about these kinds of work that digital media create that are not necessarily the work itself. All right, so Kylie Jarrett talks about all of this from a feminist perspective. If you ever want to get your feminist Marxism in one comprehensible book, this is a really great place for it. Neff talks about workers in New York who were involved in online magazines and things like that, and how instead of being funded by venture capitalists who they hoped would get their business going, they invested in their own work with their own labor. So venture labor, meaning that they take on the burden of risk themselves. Instead of the venture capitalists doing it, the worker takes on the risk. And then if they fail, they say, I didn't work hard enough. Right? It's not that society failed me, it's that I personally should have done more. Marwick talks about Silicon Valley and the rise of this idea of self-branding, people feeling like I have to have a brand if I'm going to be a coder. And then Brooke Duffy, in a very nice new book, talks about beauty bloggers, people hoping to be able to make a living as bloggers. She talks about hope labor, the work that's based on the hope that it will pay off. All of these are great ways to think about labor. I find relational labor more useful for my own purposes because it really emphasizes that building of a relational connection between people, which is part of all of this, but they all have different ways of looking. So a few years ago, MTV did a study of your generation, and what they found was an expectation that musicians should be constantly available, especially online. They should be sharing unique and intimate moments of their lives. There's an expectation for direct interaction, and they claim, and I'm still not totally convinced it's true, but they claim that millennials crave intimate glimpses into the mundane daily activities of their favorite celebrities. So again, this, what did you have for breakfast, Rihanna? As a consequence, musicians really feel this pressure, right? I'm supposed to be doing this. I don't know how necessarily. I'm not sure I want to, but I feel like I'm supposed to be. I had the chance earlier this week to speak at Universal Music Group in London, and I had a room about this size full of people, many in marketing, many in other areas, and I said, well, how many of you don't think social media is important? Don't think musicians need to connect in some sort of personal way with their audience? No hands, right? Everybody just takes for granted that, of course, this is something you're supposed to do. Part of this is because if you don't do this, people will forget about you, right? In an age where we're constantly refreshing our Facebook feeds, our Twitter feeds, our Instagram feeds, whatever feeds we have, or we're looking at the stories all the time, if something doesn't come in, we might not notice it. So especially given that the music press is so skeletal now that, you know, when I was a kid, there were so many music magazines and you just subscribed to all of them and you knew when people were coming out with new albums and you knew what their tour dates were. But now, if they don't come to you to tell you, you might not notice. So you have to be connected in this way just in order to remain visible. But it's more than that. You also have to be connected in this way to get people to pay for what you're doing. So this is Zoe Keating, who is a cellist. She is a solo cellist. She uses lots of pedals to do looping, and she builds these fantastic audioscapes of very ethereal, beautiful, beautiful music, but a very weird genre. It's not like, you know, you can go look at the solo looping cello charts to see who's doing well this week. She's kind of one of a kind. She's got millions of followers on Twitter because she's got fans at Twitter who, in the early days of Twitter, when you created an account, you could press one button and automatically be subscribed, be following a group of people, and she was one of the people on that list. So she talks about knowing that people listen to her music, but it's because they got to know her on Twitter that they then choose to pay for it. So she says, people have been listeners for a while, and then it wasn't until they got to know me on Twitter that they bought my album. So if you think about this for a minute, what you see is that they're not paying for music, right? They're not spending money. They're not buying the album to get the music. They've already been listening. So what are they paying for? They're paying for her personality, right? They're paying because they care about her as an individual. So she has to be sort of selling herself. All right, so music's predicting you having to sell yourself in order to have a career. Music, in a lot of ways, this kind of makes sense because music is a form of communication. As the ethnomusicologist Tom Torino wrote, it's a kind of communication that offers different ways of being human than language. And if you look throughout history, you see that every culture that we know of has music. It sounds very different. It uses different scales, very different instruments, but there is no society that exists in recorded history that has no music. They might have very, very different rules about music, but but it's always there. And it's historically something that people do together as part of ritual events. Perhaps it's a funeral, perhaps it's a parade, often it's a worship ceremony. But what it is not throughout history is a person who's working as a musician performing for an audience who are at leisure enjoying the spectacle. It's part of some other activity, and there is no concept of audience, let alone fans. You know, back in the days of the bone flute, people were running around going, "Oh man, you got to go see Erg play. He is a killer bone flutist, flautist." Nacho Vegas, a Spanish musician, talks about when you talk to a friend, you think in a logical way, but there's another way of communicating that has nothing to do with logic. These are the confusing things that you have to put in song. And if you think about your own experience with music, you've probably had moments where a song made you cry, even though you couldn't quite say why, or it made you really happy, or you felt... I know I often have times where I feel... I shouldn't say often. I occasionally have times where I feel just really cranky and kind of mad and angry, and then I put on Madrigada's album Grit, and I go, "Oh, yeah, they get it. That's how I feel right now." And then I feel so much better because of that album, right? And it's the confusing things that we have to put in song, and when we hear it in song, then we go, "Oh, yes, that. You understand. We share this experience as humans. I'm not alone. Others know what it feels like to feel this way." Very powerful. And language can't quite get us there somehow. Language is amazing. I love language. But music does something about feeling. It helps us communicate feeling in a way that language just can't. Georgina Bourne, the anthropologist and musicologist, talks about how music can do this at so many different scales. She talks about music inflecting existing social relations. And inflect is a sort of a peculiar word. It's like reflect, but the difference between reflecting and inflecting is that inflecting changes things a little bit. So it reflects back, but it also changes what happens next. So she's saying it inflects social relationships, and I've just put in yellow the kinds of social factors that music shapes. And as you can see, she's got it ranging from very personal things like sexuality to things like capitalism's multipolar economy, right? So from the most intimate to the most global, you see music shaping what happens. So although music... I'm sorry, yes?
Would you say that music is like an emotional amplifier instead of like something that directs you into one emotion?
I think it's both. I think it's both. I think that people turn to music in order to change the way they feel, and then they also turn to music to amplify the way they feel, and I think it can do both things. Yeah, sometimes at the same time. Yeah, nice question. Any other questions? Okay. So, since at least the age of the bone flute, and presumably before, since they bothered to invent the bone flute, music has been a form of communication, but at some point it turned into a business. So let me talk a bit about how that happened. The invention of notation, which I've talked about, was very important because it meant that there was a thing you could sell. You could sell the sheet music. Prior, you could sell a performance, perhaps, although that didn't actually happen except through patronage. But once there's a thing that's written down, there's an object that you can sell to somebody else. Around 1600, you get the invention of the concert hall. And we don't usually think of this as a platform, but I like to think of this as a platform. As my colleague Tarleton Gillespie has talked about, the stage is the original platform, and literally it means a thing you stand upon. And there's a wonderful book by the late Christopher Small where he does a fantastic analysis of the concert hall and what kind of relationships it creates amongst people. And part of his point, we think now about, oh, well, Facebook makes you relate in certain ways or whatnot. Well, so does this, right? We don't think of it that way, but this sends very clear messages about what people's roles are. Right? These are the people you're supposed to pay attention to. They're the ones who are at work. These people are not supposed to talk to each other. They're supposed to stay in the same spot. They're supposed to focus their attention on this. These people are more important than these people. Right? It tells you a lot about how you're supposed to act, what the norms are, what the rules are, who's important. This person is the most important person. He's the conductor. Right? So we know this from the architecture of this platform, what people's roles are in it. About 50 years after this was invented, in the late 1600s, the ticket was invented, which was the first time people paid to go see music. And then, of course, in the around the turn of the 20th century, recording was invented. This is Nipper, the RCA Victrola dog. Does anybody know what Nipper is sitting on? You all recognize Nipper, right? You've seen this image before. Some of you? Okay. The gramophone. Nipper is sitting, the motto that went with this was his master's voice. And Nipper is sitting on a coffin listening to his dead master's voice. It's very gloomy. I want my human. Once recording happened, if sheet music meant that you could have music without musicians, recording meant you could hear music without musicians, which this is like 120 years we've been able to hear music without musicians present. It's really not very long. 40,000 years before Christ, we've got musical instruments, and it's only in the last 150 that we've been able to hear it without musicians around. So huge, huge shift here. And there was actually a period in the 1940s where the American Federation of Musicians went on strike and refused to record music, saying, "We will not be forced to play at our own funeral." So it's rather ironic now that 70 years later they're saying, "Nobody will buy our recordings. This is so unfair." In his book about the American Federation of Musicians, James Craft wrote that to the extent that musicians' experience is representative, it bodes ill for workers in our age of rapid technological and institution innovation, suggesting that the benefits of new technology will be distributed unevenly, more or less according to power relations between the major groups affected by technology. He wrote this in 1996, or published it in 96. I would say it's pretty clear with the way wealth inequity is happening and who's at the top of the wealth inequity. It's the technologists, right? It's the guys who came up with Microsoft, who came up with Google, who came up with Facebook, who came up with Twitter. So he was very ahead of the curve, as was music, in predicting the way that technology would create these disproportionate kinds of power and wealth. All right. So how do social media platforms themselves affect the ways that people interact? Let's look at the advice that Twitter gives to musicians for how to be, if you're a musician, how should you be good at Twitter? And this is from one of Twitter's blogs, Advice for Musicians, and they say, for music fans, Twitter is the next best thing to being backstage. Again, think about that concert hall with the backstage that you don't even see in that picture because you're not supposed to be there unless you're special. Right? But now with Twitter, everybody can go backstage. It's the next best thing, right? And for performers, connecting with your fans in an authentic way is one key to your success, unless, of course, you're Avril Lavigne, and then don't be authentic, fake it. A Twitter connection tells fans how much you appreciate them, and it enables you to tailor your message. The fact is, Twitter provides more authenticity and creative control than any other online medium. Tweets come straight from you, and go right to your followers all over the world in real time. And what I want to emphasize about this quote is that some of these qualities, that tweets come straight from you and that they go right to your followers all over the world in real time, these qualities, they're built into the platform. They are how it works, right? There's no way to use Twitter but this. That's just how the platform works. It is global, it is real time, it is from a single one to many, many to many. Authenticity is not how the platform works. right? We know from the rise of fake news that you can lie like crazy on Twitter. There's nothing about Twitter that is automatically authentic. So there's this mix of what the platform makes possible and then the social norms that emerge around how those qualities are perceived. Okay, so an affordance, sometimes people think of affordances as being properties of the technology, but an affordance is a mix between the properties of the technology and the ways that that technology is perceived. Right, so by offering these technological qualities, it creates this relational affordance of authenticity because people see it that way. Not because it has to be that way, but because that's how people see it. So you get a norm of authenticity that is not necessary, but that arises through the mix of the technological features and the social ways it's adopted. Some of the things that are shaped by relational affordances are things like the participation frameworks. If you think about that concert hall, who's got the floor? Who's got the right to speak? The person on stage. The others don't. If you think about Twitter, who's got the floor? Who's got the right to speak? Anybody who wants to, right? And in fact, when Beyonce tweets, her tweets look exactly like my tweets. You can't tell them apart structurally. Right? Obviously, if she ever did tweet, the world would shake in ways that it doesn't when I tweet. But both of us have equal access to the floor. So things like that really change. And there's many other ways in which who can participate on what terms change because of the affordances of social media, including who can talk to whom and who can listen. Changes also. So if you think about a concert hall, it used to be that to go to a concert to hear an artist, you had to pay, right? Which meant you had to care. You probably liked them. You probably weren't going to go pay to see somebody you hated just so you could yell at them, right? On social media, you don't have to pay. You can yell at anybody you want, right? Which means people get abused a lot. The time limits change quite a bit, and the expectations about are you going to respond change, so that if it was a record store signing, people would come up and you'd sort of say hi and you'd sign it and then it would be over and nobody would say, hey, how come you didn't write back? You signed my record yesterday, right? But with social media, people do expect you to respond. And so there's an expectation that the relationship is going to keep going. And if people don't respond, they might be judged negatively. One of my favorite, and in some ways to me saddest quotes, was when I talked to Seer Hyam, and he talked about how there's some people, I hope it's not any of you, who follow him on every single platform and message him all the time, and he doesn't want to be mean, so he replies to them all, and it's just exhausting to keep up with it, right? So he feels this real pressure that he's going to keep maintaining this relationship with all of these people because he doesn't want to be rude, and they've spoken to him, and of course you should speak back when somebody speaks, right? That's an expectation that didn't exist when their first album came out, right? You could go to the record signing, you could sign, and you were done. They were happy. But now, if you go to his Facebook page, he replies to tons of comments all the time. He's very interactive there. The power balances change so that audiences might have more power. So you see, for example, lots of efforts to get the audiences to do publicity on your behalf because audiences are so powerful in ways they didn't used to be. And the limits on behavior change, like I was saying. People will yell at people, abuse people, be mean to people, things that they didn't expect. For artists, this might mean that it used to be fine to just present in your rock star persona, but now if you go onto social media and you act like a rock star, people think you're a jerk, right? You're supposed to be talking about what you had for breakfast. If you treat it like a broadcast medium where you just say, I will be performing tonight here. My record is available there. Read the interview with me here. And people are like, oh, you're using social media wrong. Right? So that changes. The topics that people are supposed to talk about change. Suddenly it's not enough to just talk about your work. You're supposed to talk about all these other things too. And then, like I'm saying, the norms and expectations for behavior change also. So social media platforms affect all of these things. And of course, this is not true just of music. This is true of all kinds of industries. One of the things journalists are struggling with a lot is these issues. What am I allowed? Can I, dare I express that I have an opinion about the events I'm covering? Is that appropriate? I'm supposed to be authentic because it's social media, right? So these are problems that a lot of people are wrestling with. As I was saying, relationships are dialectics, which is to say that we're always being pulled between competing tensions. This book by Leslie Baxter and Barbara Montgomery called Relating has been very important to me in understanding communication. It's about interpersonal relationships, relationships between friends, romantic partners, within families, things like that. And what they argue is that people are always being pulled in multiple competing directions. Like I said earlier, it's not like you form a relationship, you got married, congratulations, now you're done, you can stop working at it, right? So they describe social life existing in and through people's communicative practices by which people give voice to multiple, perhaps even infinite, opposing tendencies. So social life is an unfinished, ongoing dialogue in which many, many dialectical voices struggle against one another. And in that struggle, they set up the next struggles. So we're never done. We're always trying to balance. A dialectic that we all experience, there are quite a few we all experience. One of them is the desire to be very interdependent with the people that we care about most. We want to consult them before we make decisions. They want them to consult us before we make decisions. If they go see a movie that we wanted to see without us, we're annoyed because how could they see that without me? We're supposed to do it together. So that desire for interdependence and interconnectedness, but at the same time, we also want to be left alone to make our own decisions, to do what we want, whenever we want to. And if I want to go see a movie, of course I can go see a movie. Why should I have to tell you I'm going to see that movie? Right? And these are both very, very valid desires, the desire for autonomy and the desire for interdependence, but they're opposed to one another. So we always have to balance that. Sometimes there's different ways to balance dialectics. Sometimes people just sort of pretend one of them doesn't exist and they just stay on the other side, which can work for a while, but tends to backfire eventually. Another will be to sort of alternate between. So you might say, well, when we're together, we do everything together, but then we take a lot of time apart and do our own things. Or the most sophisticated way to resolve these is to sort of step back and see them as part of a whole. So you might say something like, we're so close that we can spend a lot of time apart and yet still feel together. Right? So then you're saying we got both ends in the same package. There are two main dialectics that I focus on in the book that arise because of all of these relational dynamics. Basically, what I'm saying is that these tensions are always there, but the context that we're in and the technologies we're using push us toward one end or another. So if you think about recording and records and the age of rock stars and records, it was an age where audiences were markets that you would control, right? You would advertise to them, you would seek to influence them. In an age where everybody's posting their own stuff, the push is toward participation, toward communities. So these are in contrast. If you are thinking about your audience as a market, you're trying to control them, you're trying to manipulate them, you might be trying to count them and do smart data things to figure out which ones of them matter most and where you need to be and all of those things. It's not inherently bad. Sides of dialectics are never inherently bad. They're just facts, right? If you're in capitalism, you got to sort of think of people as a market, and you have to sort of try to control them, because otherwise the competition will win. But at the same time, if you're thinking about people as a community, then you're thinking about it as a participatory practice in which you're all part of it. Think about those early images of music that I put up versus that concert hall, right? Yes, Earl?
Do you think that there is a possibility that right now we're seeing a convergence of both? Like, for example, pushing people to participate just so that we can gather their data, get their sentiment data so that we can monetize that?
Yes. I think the trick with that is that if people perceive that you're doing it in order to get their data so it can be monetized, then it stops feeling like a community and they resent you for it. So the tension is still there. I think in the best cases, what we're seeing is where, because you're fostering community and because you're fostering participation, your market does really well, right? Whether you're doing those things or not. So they certainly go together. But as Happy Tom says, do you want to be part of a community that's all about sales, that's all about harvesting your data? People kind of mix that up. They think, we need a community. It's a big buzzword. Well, treat it like a community. Treat it like something you're part of, not a sales channel. It's not a TV shop. I think that's something we should cherish, like a little baby bird. If you listen to Turbo Negro, I hope you appreciate hearing him say, cherish like a little baby bird. But there's the contrast right there, right? Is your audience a sales channel or is your is it a community? He also talked to me about going to Turbo Negro fans. I don't know if any of you are Turbo Negro fans, but they are hardcore fans. It is a serious, serious fan community. They have annual get-togethers in Hamburg where they all wear their Turbo Negro fan uniforms. And they go and they play at this event. And he says, it's the best of both worlds because I stand on stage and they all idolize me, but then they get tired of idolizing me, so I just go down and have a beer with them and we hang out. Right? So he moves between it's a market, it's a community, and goes back and forth. For other people, this is a very difficult bridge. Sometimes they don't want to be participating with their fans, and sometimes they don't want to be selling to their fans, right? So either side of this can be uncomfortable for artists. The other really important dialectic that people struggle with is between the distant relationship, where you're the star and they're the fans, and the close relationship, where you're all friends, right? And certainly, as we see with Rihanna, this is the pressure right now. You're supposed to be close. You're supposed to be like friends. It's supposed to be semi-intimate. And if you prefer distance and you'd rather treat them like fans, like Avril Lavigne, then you're going to be punished, right? You're going to be seen as being bad at it, as being aloof and awkward and problematic. Again, neither one of these is good or bad. They're both perfectly valid, but they're in tension with each other. And an individual person may want both. Lloyd Cole is somebody who prefers distance. And he says, I've met some of my heroes, and it's not always a good thing.
Sorry.
Thanks for coming. And I do think that inequality in the relationship is what keeps it alive. And I think that one of the things that's possible with my web presence is that the last shards of my mystique are in danger of being completely obliterated. Right? And sometimes when I have shared this quote with people, they've said something like, I don't like him. Which, again, it's the Avril Lavigne phenomenon, right? It's be authentic, but not that kind of authentic. And yet, I think he's got a very valid point, because from his point of view, he sees his music as, he's crafting beautiful objects, and he wants people to experience those things on their own terms. He wants you to go to the museum and look at the painting and just experience the painting. He doesn't want you to experience the artist standing between you and the art. And he's concerned that if he has no mystique, then people are experiencing the music always through who is he, and whether they like him or not is shaping it. Right? And people struggle with this all the time. Like right now we're having, I think, two moments that are extremely public around this with R. Kelly and people saying, R. Kelly, keeps underage sex slaves. This is totally not okay. How can we love his music still, right? And the new Michael Jackson documentary, we're seeing the same phenomenon where people are going, but I love Michael Jackson's music. How can I listen to it if I believe what this documentary is saying about his history with young boys? So there's good reasons. You don't have to be committing crimes against people for your personality to get in the way of people's appreciation of your art. It can. I've certainly met artists and not listened to them again after that. And then sometimes it changes it in ways that can reshape the way you see art, even if you like the person, right? Like when I met Sievert Hajim, I'm like, dang, you're like a really nice guy, but you sound so mean in Madrugada, and that was kind of exciting, right? Now I listen to that, and I'm like, that's a persona. He's not really mean like that. He's actually a nice person. Dang. Aaron McKeown talks about Twitter and Facebook demanding fresh personal content and that feeling at odds for her with what she's willing to share with people. Aaron likes to have really clear boundaries between you're my fans and you're my friends, because early in her career, she had interactions with fans as friends, and then she felt like she was used, like those fans then went off and said, well, I hung out with Aaron McKeown, aren't I cool? And she was like, I don't want to be used like that. That's not what I want. So the fans, you're over here. Friends, you're over here. And I'm going to keep you apart. So she's not wildly popular. She says she's got 3,000 or 4,000 followers. But it's enough to give her anxiety about how do I communicate in a way that is sincere and genuine and meaningful and reflects my personality, but that also isn't completely transparent or that has boundaries without the appearance of having boundaries. Interestingly, for both her and Lloyd Cole, two people who really prefer distance and feel anxiety about being pushed to closeness, they have both found sports to be a topic that allows them to do this. So Cole likes to talk about golf, and she likes to talk about baseball. Because they really are sports fans, and then nobody notices that she's not talking about her romantic partners. You might think that big stars would prefer distance rather than closeness, but you would be wrong. It's very, very personal. Just as Aaron is a not big star who prefers distance, Roger O'Donnell plays keyboards for The Cure, a rather large band. For him, he likes the friendship. He likes the lack of distance. He doesn't like to call them fans. Not anymore. They're more like friends. People that are interested in my music and what I'm doing, I get 3 or 4 emails a day, and I answer, and I have good conversations with people. Right? And in a way, perhaps this is partly because in a band as huge as The Cure, he's so cut off from his audience that he can kind of regain some of that sense of connection that there would have been in historic times between performer and audience. So Kraft raises the question of who benefits from this. Are the benefits evenly distributed, or do they increase the power divide? And I've certainly been arguing that, or at least I argued earlier, that the potential to increase the power divide is quite large. And indeed, Rihanna's one of the most popular people on all of Twitter, and poor Rihanna is, in 2017, was only worth $36 million. In comparison to Zuckerberg, co-founder of Facebook, who was worth $74 billion, or Ev Williams, co-founder of Twitter, who was worth a paltry just shy of $2 billion. And obviously, we can't feel sorry for Rihanna for only being worth $36 million. And I don't resent Zuckerberg and Williams for being rich. They invented things that lots and lots and lots of people use. Making a lot of money probably seems fair. But I do think we can ask, especially when we consider ourselves compared to Rihanna, is this an equitable distribution of benefits, of all of the value that's being generated through these social media platforms? Is the wealth being fairly distributed? Is the power being fairly distributed? And I would say, given that, if everybody who feels like they need to engage in relational labor quit doing it on social media today, there would be dramatically less content on these platforms. I would say no, it's not being equitably distributed. We are providing all of the content, and we are seeing very few of the financial benefits, and in fact, we're seeing a huge gulf between the haves and have-nots that these platforms are facilitating. Not because of their structure, but because of their economics and the way that wealth gets distributed around and through them. So I want to finish just by thinking for a minute about what would it mean in this environment when people are expected to do relational labor, when it's an almost a demand. What does it mean for people to flourish, for this to be what David Hesmondalch and Sarah Baker called good work, work that's meaningful, that feels valuable? And I've got a list here. Right? These are the things that after listening to all of these people and spending all of this time, these are the things that I think relational labor should do for people. This is what would make it a more fair world. So one, people should be able to have sustainable and dignified careers. And by dignified, I mean, for example, you shouldn't have to do an ad for a product you don't like if you don't want to do advertising in order to get enough money to make your next record. Right, so people want to be able to hold their heads high and be proud of the work that they're doing, and they want to be able to do it over time. In the ideal, people have organized resources and assistance so they don't have to make up how to do it and figure it out as though they're the first people ever to try to do this, which is what tends to happen. Record labels will provide that kind of support for people, but most people are not on record labels, and most people who are get dropped after their second album. So very few people have sustained support from record labels. People should be able to choose where they want to be in terms of controlling their own work. People are often told, oh, well, you have to give it away. You have to share your work. You have to let fans distribute it. You have to let fans do whatever. Some people love that and are very excited for fans to do their own things with their music, and some people hate it and really don't want that. And I don't think that anybody should be forced. I think people should be able to have autonomy over whether they want to protect their art or want people to take it apart and remix and do all their own things with it. I think that people have a right to a workplace that is a safe environment, in the same way that if you are a barista, you should be able to go to Espresso House and make your cappuccinos without customers sexually abusing you. You should be able to go onto Facebook and post on your page without people sending you rape threats, right? But that's not what happens. What happens is that these are very unsafe environments, especially for women and especially for people of color. There's a lot of abuse that happens there. There's also great stuff that happens there to those same people, but you can't get to the good stuff without getting through the icky stuff. And I don't think that the platforms do enough to keep those environments safe. Relationships in general, an intimate relationship should, and this is true in your romantic lives as well, so if this isn't happening in your love life, dump that person when you get home today, should help you understand yourself and make you understand your value, because we are all valuable people, right? So a good relationship helps you understand yourself and helps you feel valuable. And relational labor should do the same, and indeed, the high points of relational labor for people I spoke with were things like, I got an email from somebody who said, my father just died and all I can do is listen to your music. And I realized, my work matters. My life has meaning. This is important, what I'm doing here. Right? So relational labor absolutely can increase people's self-understanding and increase their self-worth. It often does. But at the same time, it can also be destructive. For example, we see a trend recently of micro-celebrities and influencers quitting because they're finding that their self-worth is being torn down and they're not sure who they are anymore because they're under so many commercial pressures to act like they really like that little skirt they wore on Instagram or whatnot, when really Zara sent it to them and they don't really like it and they lose their sense of who am I and why am I doing this and why does it even matter? So these things are at risk, but they also at the same time can be really enhanced through relational labor. Relational labor ought to promote community. I absolutely believe that the key to a sustainable career in the creative industries is building a community that really cares about your work around you, because then they care about each other. And when they care about each other, they keep caring about you even when they don't like you anymore, because that's where their friends are. I started my career writing about a soap opera discussion group, and one of the phenomena that happened there was that people would keep watching the soap opera long after they stopped liking it, only to be able to follow the conversations people were having on the discussion forum because they liked those people so much, right? And the musician Billy Bragg told me that he gave the example of a woman who comes to his shows in England all the time, and he says she's completely clear she hasn't bought an album I've made in 10 years and she doesn't even like my music anymore, but she'd never miss my shows because that's what she and her friends do. They go to my shows together. Right? So when you've got a community that care about each other, they have to keep doing it, because to give you up is to give up their friendship community. And, of course, community is just good in general. As I've said, I think the benefit should be distributed more equitably. And finally, I think Avril Lavigne has the right to not touch people. I think people should have the right to a private life when they're professionals. And I don't think that we've figured out how to do this yet, but I basically think that the pressure to have these more intimate relationships with people is profoundly unfair when that's not the work that they're being paid for, right? People should have the right to just make great music and not have to be your best friend in order to get people to pay attention and buy their music. I don't know how that happens, but these are the ideals. So if you go out in the world and work on any of these things, these are your goals. So I will leave it at that, and I'm very happy to take questions or comments or a break or whatever you like. Thank you. Thank you.
It's not often you say a presentation touches you, but it touches me.
Cool.
Could you elaborate a bit on relational labor in the context of journalism? I know you're not a digital journalism scholar, but I know...
I was a journalism undergrad.
...and that you went to the Tao Center in Colombia, as you mentioned. is this concept really...
I think that it's something that is both expected and sort of feared, right? So that you have news organizations which have prided themselves on objectivity and the illusion that journalists are these neutral vehicles through which the news is merely reported rather than subjective beings through whom the news is filtered and constructed. So the whole idea of relational labor in that way is very counter to the historic ideals of journalism. I shouldn't say historic, because, of course, originally journalism was all about having very strong opinions, right? But as it got constructed in the 20th century as this neutral, objective way of understanding the world, relational labor is sort of opposite to that, because journalism is supposed to be that very distant, very formal relationship where you are the authorities, you're the experts, you're speaking truth. They're the market, reading it, learning, understanding, and you're not supposed to know each other. And your vision of the news should never be shaped by who wrote the story, unless it's something like, oh yes, well, they're a very credible journalist. At the same time, as journalists see the media falling apart and see journalistic business models falling apart, and there's this desperate question of how do we stay afloat? How do we keep getting the revenue to allow us to continue doing the work that we do, it perhaps becomes more important to be making the audience care about journalists. So you have journalists both because they want to speak directly to their audiences and because they feel economic pressure to connect with their audiences, engaging in relational labor, where they're building connections with audiences and where you're having backs and forths. Silly things sometimes, like, for example, Laura Seidel from National Public Radio in the States follows me on Twitter, and now and then she'll like something I post or whatnot, and I'm like, ooh, Laura Seidel from NPR liked my tweet. Isn't that cool? Right? And now when I hear her on the radio, I'm like, that's Laura. That's my pal Laura. I made a funny comment about Nancy Pelosi the other day, another short little Nancy people don't take seriously enough. And she liked that one, right? So it's like a little glimmer into, oh, she's got a few thoughts about Nancy Pelosi not being taken seriously, right, if she liked that one. So I think that journalists, and as you know, it gets discussed a lot, right? Okay, so journalists, we're supposed to be on social media, and we're supposed to be engaging our audiences, and we're supposed to be promoting our stories through social media. And yet the norms of social media are that you're going to be authentic and you're going to have opinions and you're going to have subjectivity. So you get these really mixed messages like get online, engage your audiences, promote your stories, but don't have opinions, right? And then if the journalist is there doing that, then they're doing social media wrong. Because people want journalists to have opinions. But then if they do have opinions, then the people with different opinions attack the press. So I think journalists are really caught in a very difficult bind around relational labor because the expectation is there that they're going to be doing it, and yet it's counter to the ideals of journalism that they be having personal relations. And you see them struggle with it explicitly on social media where they're really trying to figure out how much can I reveal about what I think is happening here? Or they're pretending they don't have opinions when people know that they do. Yeah, it's a really interesting domain, and I'm looking forward to people using this concept in that field and seeing how it shakes out. Because it's certainly not going to be the same for music as for journalism, because, of course, musicians are meant to be opinionated. They're meant to have stand. They're meant to be expressing themselves, right, where a journalist... You're not supposed to be expressing yourself. You're supposed to be reporting truth. Yeah?
Thanks. Thanks for the great presentation. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Just continuing on the question, Oscar asked, because there's some sort of an emerging discourse within journalism and journalism studies now that sort of journalists have overestimated the audience's willingness to actually participate and be relational with journalists and journalism, and that it's about only like 10% of audiences that actually want to be engaged in that way, with sort of writing comments to stories and getting in touch with journalists and so forth, and that journalists and newsrooms as well spend too much time sort of catering to those people that make up these 10%.
Yeah.
Instead of sort of caring about the other 90% who just not sort of share news or comment on stories, but are still engaged in journalism.
Right.
And do you find the same thing with music as well? Because I assume that not all fans are sort of that interested in actually getting those, getting intimate relations with the stars.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why when I define relational labor as careers that seem to depend upon this kind of personal connection, I'm not convinced. I think it probably is quite true in music. I would not be in the least bit surprised if 90% of people who listen to music have no interest in knowing what that artist ate for breakfast.
Yeah.
Right? So I think, and again, this is a reason that I think it's really important to think about where does this pressure to do relational labor come from and to follow the money, to where did the economic benefits of doing it go? And note that, gosh, they don't actually go to the journalists and the press. And they don't actually go to the musicians and to the record labels. They go to the platforms, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that, I think you're absolutely right. I think another piece with journalism is, of course, that journalists love Twitter, right? So journalists are all on Twitter talking to other journalists, which sort of creates the illusion that Twitter is where you have to be if you're a journalist, even though it's mostly journalists there talking to each other. Right? There was a study that came out recently. Shannon McGregor was one of the authors showing that journalists are much more likely to cover things they run across on Twitter, that Twitter is the origin for so many stories. So there is, you're exactly right, there's this very warped world where it's a very small percent, really, that think that the world revolves around these connections on social media, but they have an outsized influence more broadly. Yeah, and I think that is true in music, too. Yeah.
I'm not sure how to phrase the question, but it is related to what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have some people who argue that the music industry is going in a direction where marketing and social media and connecting with your fans is almost more important than music. In, like, for some artists,
mm-hmm.
you have some artists who, like, their music is okay, it's not been, like, spectacular. Like
I think you're quite right that what makes that people will have followings because they're a great personality rather than because their music is great. That's not entirely new, right? We've had a lot of, throughout history, a lot of recording stars who looked fabulous and the producers could make them sound fabulous and they knew how to dance. So that's what made them famous rather than because they were good songwriters or good singers or good guitarists or whatever. But I do think that, I think there is a shift where it's more easy to become very popular very quickly because of a bubbly, engaging personality of some kind. Time will tell, but my sense is that those careers are going to be harder to sustain than the ones where the music is actually really high quality. Because, you know, you can still be really moved by music that was recorded 10 years ago, and you may still want to go buy that old album or something, or stream it and get some streams. It's pretty hard to be moved by an Instagram story somebody posted 10 years ago, right? So, and it's easy to tire of personalities, too, over time. I think it's easier to tire of a personality than it is to tire of a really wonderful song. So I think that it's, in a way, it's sort of like instant celebrity versus being in it for the long haul kind of a problem. And I don't know where it goes. You're seeing some really interesting kind of strategies where people are building audiences and then becoming musicians, for example. And I guess I don't really have a good answer about what I think the future of it is. The future seems to be so up for grabs right now. Every day it looks a little bit different. But I think in the short term, personality is so important. And in the long term, I at least hope that the quality of what you're doing is important. And I don't want to be judgmental about what's good music and what's bad music, right? What counts as good music might be something I don't like at all, right? But it has to have that ability to reach people and give them a sense of what they feel and who they are and who they connect to and their place in the world somehow. An example that I really find interesting along these lines is OK Go. Remember they had that great video with the treadmills? And do you remember the tune that went with that video? I don't. I remember the video really well. I can't hum a bar from that no matter how many times I watch. Completely forgettable song. Sorry, OK Go, if you're watching. But a very powerful presence, right? So I think, bye, thanks, Earl. So I think that I think there's a danger. But if you make a lot of money in the short run, maybe it doesn't matter. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Which in a way is kind of parallel to how you would have the opening act, opening the tour in hopes to break them, except for that when you had the opening act, you were hoping to develop them into something that would make money of its own for the long haul. So in general, I think that the culture industries are moving toward viewing musicians as disposable goods, where if you can get one album out of them that sells or one single, that's great, and then on to the next one, which is part of this whole erasure of social support that's happening in general and of networks that sustain and help build. It used to be that a label would really take time to develop an artist, and it was fine if it was your fifth album that took off because you'd spent all those years building them into what they became. Whereas now, the labels aren't willing to invest that time to nurture somebody and help them develop a career. I just saw, I think it's something like 98 or 99% of artists on major labels lose the contract after the second album. So it's almost all of them. Just about every single one of them is not going to get that support over the long haul. So, and in fairness, the labels are desperate too. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know what's going on. It's not like they've got it all figured out. They're just, oh, I need cash now. Yeah.
Thanks, Nancy. We said, to kind of round up, but now, and it's very important for Nancy that she's able to go and drop her computer and do important field work. She's going to meet with another fan, have some dinner, and do field work at the concert. And then tomorrow, with another friend, do more field work at the same concert.
It's going to be a different concert. Same venue, same band, different concert.
Yeah, new concert. That just sounds like a lovely job for the weekend.
It's a tough job, but somebody's got to go to all these rock concerts. Yeah.
Thank you, Nancy. It was great.
Thank you for having
you.
Me. Thank you.